Let me add my sort of welcome to Amit. When we organized the workshop last year, it was quite amazing that in the last, I'm a sort of neophyte to this area of mathematical oncology, but certainly I've been working in brain biomechanics for a number of years. And I think over the past 10 years, the last 5 years have seen a sort of explosive interest in this sort of interdisciplinary area of research. What's even more amazing is that in the past, when you had mathematicians and medical scientists and biologists sort of interacting, it was really an excuse for mathematicians to do mathematics. So, you'd take a problem, formulate it, and then you'd have some nice theorems that sort of took off. And so for a long time, I think, rightfully, medical practitioners didn't really want to talk to mathematicians. And the last meeting was amazing in the sense how many interdisciplinary projects are going on and how many models actually use data. And, you sort of fit your parameters to the data, and then you use that model to sort of suggest possible other experiments that might verify the predictive power of the model. So it's a sort of really much more hands-on thing. And in a sense, very daunting, because, in a problem where the biological or medical basis is poorly understood, it's sort of a bit daunting to think that, mathematically you can do anything, but it's amazing how much can be done. I feel a bit like a charlatan standing here, but, because I sort of collared Amit to talk at the last meeting, he sort of suggested in a moment of weakness that I give the give the opening talk here, and I sort of said yes. But of course, in the last week or so, while I've been rummaging through, I've just found that, that's why I've called it an extremely brief overview, and, I should have pinched John Adams' title, A Personal Perspective, because, I dug up Philip Meany's letter to Nature with Gattenby, and, I just discovered that he's not wrong. He says, experimental oncology is awash with data. In 2001 alone, 21,000 articles characterizing, diagnosing, treating malignancies was published. I certainly wasn't going to review all 21,000. What I thought I'd do is, my perspective on this is really my interaction with Amit over the past year and a half or 2 years, and with the sort of work we've started to do. So, I'll focus on a narrow part, but a part which I think is sort of quite crucial and important. And of course, neglect a whole area like stochastic processes and things like that, those sort of approaches which are definitely useful. But I'll just try and focus on practical issues that will be of relevance to the oncologist, in a clinical oncologist. Okay, so what I was going to do was really just start off by generally talking about biological processes, such as cell proliferation. If you think about it, these processes are very tightly controlled biologically. And these are mainly through chemical mediation, right? So I guess the fundamental problem in all this is how some types of cells manage to escape these sort of control mechanisms. Now, if you think about it, each day, the human body produces sort of millions and millions of cells. And each cell works really like a sort of exceedingly complicated machine. So you're inputting sort of nutrients and outputting sort of energy, but this is in the form of it'll sort of the cell will put out proteins and enzymes as dictated by its particular DNA. And in addition to this, the cell uses various sort of modes for communicating with other cells in the vicinity or at long distances. Now, as I mentioned, in the last few years, I think the importance of mathematical modeling in the medical sciences, and in particular oncology, has really taken off. And I think it's now sort of widely accepted as a sort of nice sort of synergy, in a way you can sort of dictate research programs and actually give practical input. The literature now sort of abounds with sort of great success stories and, sort of breakthroughs that have been made with this sort of interaction of experimentalists and theoreticians. And, there's probably millions of examples, but, certainly in cellular processes, things that spring immediately to mind are, descriptions of the oscillations in the cell cycle leading to regular cell division. other things, intercellular calcium waves, which mediate cellular response over large areas. And the third thing I just sort of put up was tumor growth response to chemo and radiotherapy. Now those are just some examples of the numerous, none of which I think could have been achieved independently, you know, with sort of just experimentalists, or it would have, you know, with great trouble could have maybe been achieved, but the sort of symbiosis of the two really played a key role. So if I look at the types of problems that I think will form in the next sort of, I don't know, however many years, a focus for mathematical oncologists, you know, one of the things I thought was the optimization of chemotherapy, this is what Amit is interested in, of chemotherapy and other protocols. And potentially this obviously has great practical importance, right? I mean, there are classical models, you know, population models described by ODEs and, you know, systems of ODEs with control terms that sort of correspond to intervention, okay, you know, chemotherapy intervention or radiotherapy or whatever. And the most common approach over, I would say, the last 15, 20 years has been to sort of define something like a, what could be called a performance index. Okay, and this performance index really measures the efficacy of the therapy and also factors in, you know, how badly, say, the therapy affects normal tissue. And then the standard thing has been to use sort of control theoretic methods or whatever to try and get the best value for this index. I mean, this approach was fine, I think, early on, okay, when the complexity of the tumor cell population wasn't so appreciated. I mean, there are models in the literature which sort of factor in emerging resistance, like the Coleman-Goldie model. But I think many of these models, well, I'm sort of basing it on Amit's thing, are based on sort of biologically faulty sort of hypotheses. So I think there's really, you know, challenges to include more realistic models of drug action, cell proliferation, and heterogeneity. Okay, and of course, in all of this, you need sort of new methods for parameter estimation, etc. Okay, the second thing that I think is of great importance is the development of resistance. You see, the cancer cells, you know, I've said, are genetically sort of unstable in the sense that these cells can acquire genetic and phenotypic changes that help them avoid cytotoxic insults. So there's some sort of mechanism there that we don't understand. And it's useful in a sense. I mean, we know that the resistance is often a function of frequency, intensity, and duration of a therapy, of exposure to a drug or whatever, plus, of course, the chronological age of the cells. But it would be nice to have, you know, biological parameters described in a more mathematical framework. Well, cell populations, if you look at growth and differentiation of cells, this is really one of the old chestnuts of math biology, you know, it's sort of well-developed area in biomathematics. Now, you know, there are, I mean, these sort of look at growth and differentiation of normal, say, and tumor cells, or you can pick two populations, whatever, you know, say a cell in the S phase of the cell cycle plus another, or essentially two compartment or multi-compartment type models. Now, these have been successful in the sense, I mean, there are very successful models for hematopoiesis. And so in a sense, what we'd like to do in this area is to integrate, say, newly described genetic and molecular mechanisms into models of proliferation, growth of tumors, and heterogeneity of tumors. So, okay, and then drug action. So what I mean here is the mechanisms of drug action. Now, I think, you'll have to correct me if I'm wrong here, but anti-cancer drugs generally act on molecular targets within it. And these are often involved in cell proliferation, differentiation, and cell death, and things like that. So so you really want a mathematical model to try and understand the drug-target interaction. And finally, you know, I guess drug delivery, or I keep talking about drugs, but I know a lot of people are going to talk on radiotherapy. So more generally, delivery of therapy to the target cells. I think it's generally sort of accepted that over 80% of human cancer tumors, I know Kristen's going to talk about gliomas, so please don't fall into that thing, but over 80% of them are solid tumors. So how effective a drug is how much drug diffuses into a tumor, from the site of administration. And there are sort of all sorts of questions about how you should sort of tackle this. So in a sense, the drug actually diffuses into the tumor, binds to some intracellular macromolecular things, and then causes degradation, etc. So that's the sort of mechanism. Now you can see that in a sense, suppose a drug, if you can think of a tumor as the porous medium, the porosity, it would characterize that. Now if a drug diffuses in there and causes apoptosis, then it could alter the porosity and hence the diffusivity of drug into the tumor. So you want to take all those sort of things into account and really enclose that in sort of mathematical models of how these processes affect drug delivery. Okay, so I think Amit's done a much better job of saying what the aims of the workshop are, but I've added a couple of things that I thought were sort of important things. Of course, the workshops are not the answer for everything. I think the sort of dialogue that has to continue over months and years. But in a sense, I think we've found that this sort of meeting, initiates the collaborations and interactions, which then sort of will carry on. And occasionally give a nice theorem as well. Okay. So I think you'll see in many of the talks, there'll be a summary of sort of current knowledge in various branches of oncology. It's so broad, so we've got a section of that. Some of them will give you a state of the art in various topics. So that's part of the thing that we wanted to include in the workshop. This is a little bit more tentative, but last year we found there were a number of interdisciplinary collaborations between experimentalists and theoreticians, and this may happen after. But also, I think quite crucial and important for a meeting of this nature is to, I can see a number of my guys here, but the new generation of researchers, if we want to attract them into this sort of interdisciplinary field, and I think it is a sort of thing that's happening, and students are getting interested, and I think they find the area quite challenging in a sense. Okay, so what I'm going to do now, having dug through 21,000 papers, is really to focus on, because I think, you can say that if you look at the simplistic models, starting from the simplistic form where, Festia, calculus, or DEs will sort of indicate how you should solve it, in a sense, you've got the crux of the matter because a lot of the other models sort of build on these basic models. So I'm going to start off with the single ODE-type models, or phenomenological models, I've called them. Now, mathematically speaking, models of this kind, you could say are naive and oversimplified, when you compare them with, say, sort of the reaction-diffusion-type models that appear in the literature. And, of course, there are other cellular automata, stochastic processes. There are lots of different approaches. But if you're a mathematician, say, for example, and you go off to look in the medical literature to see what types of models are currently in use, then I think in the literature you'll find that the models that are routinely used for practical medical modeling, okay, are the simple ODE models. Okay, so I'll say a little bit more as we go along. I could have started off with a simple exponential growth, but I just thought that was too simple. So let's start with the logistic equation. N here is the tumor size or number of cells. Okay. It's easy to show, it's easy to show that that the N as T tends to infinity will approach the carrying capacity K. Okay, more generally, if you look at the literature, you'll find that a near universal observation is that almost all solid tumors decelerate as they grow larger. Okay, you'll get an explosive growth phase, but it's a sort of sigmoid-type curve, and unless death intervenes or treatment, it sort of steadies out the growth. It's not sort of unbounded growth. Well, I guess physically you're restricted by the body as well, but anyway, so now looking at the literature, you'll find also that more generally, it's usually in the practical medical modeling, it's usually the estimation or specification of parameters in the simple ODE models that really forms the crux of any discussion in the literature. So such models, what they're trying to do is, you know, you've got a whole plethora of parameters. They aim to focus on key parameters and at the same time judiciously omit sort of peripheral parameters. Okay, and that's really the key to it. And if you sort of think of currently some of the, say, hardest problems in the literature, I think those are really trying to estimate parameters in a realistic manner. Okay? Now, of course, with a lot of mathematicians here, mathematical generality is always an attraction. You know, you want to use more sophisticated math. But the payoff is actually very small, you know, because a mathematically generalized model is usually just a minor elaboration of a basic ODE model based on plausible possibilities linked vaguely with actual observation, etc. So much so that I don't think, I can't speak, you know, in authority, but I don't think that there's any generalized model, PDE model, that's gained widespread acceptance. So let's have a look at it. So I said the near-universal observation is that almost all solid tumors decelerate as they grow larger. In other words, their specific growth rate decreases with time. The model that I showed, the logistic model, frequently generalized to a simple nonlinear ODE. So in other words, the right-hand side function, you just write as f of n. And that f of n, you would normally pick to have the characteristics of decreasing with time, you know, so that the growth rate decreases, etc., and other sort of things. So now the first sort of simple generalization would be the generalized logistic equation. You know, I realized I was at a meeting on Tuesday, so I was sort of rambling through this, and when I was looking through this, I thought there are too many equations. I've been telling all the speakers, make it simple and straightforward. But anyway, I just wanted to give you a flavor of it, so we won't. The stuff that I'm going to go through now is very simple, and then the more complicated things I'll just sort of skim over. But the generalized logistic equation, I noticed here that the gamma there should be a nu actually in that model there. Okay, so that's not a gamma. And so mu is greater than one. You know, you can sort of do the standard sort of things to show that it has one global attractor at the point k for n greater than zero. Now, if you let nu, so if you let nu, that should be a nu there. Okay, the same as that. If you let nu go to zero, you know, first year calculus or whatever, you know, you'll get in the limit you'll get the Gompertz model, this log term. And as I've mentioned, single ODE models are frequently applied to experimental and clinical tumors. And I put this paper here because it's a sort of recent paper where they've used an ODE type model. And in a very clear study and systematic clinical application of the generalized logistic equation to breast tumors, actually gives you an optimal nu value of approximately 0.25. The common assumption is that if you put in treatment, then you get a simple modification of that basic nonlinear ODE in the following manner. So that term there. Now that term, you know, with alpha positive, it just comes from standard reaction kinetics. So here, this is the therapeutic agent, and that's the cell. Okay, and that's where you get that from. Okay. Now, the next generalization, if you want to go that far now, is instead of a single ODE, to go to a system, two ODEs coupled in some manner. So in other words, you have two populations, you know, it could be hypoxic and normoxic tumor cells. It doesn't have to be that. It's any two compartments. So, you know, as I've mentioned here, you know, there's great interest currently in tumor cells and endothelial cells. So those would be the two compartments that you'd use in the equations. What happens here is that in the tumor compartment, you have the standard equation that we had before. And then in the endothelial compartment, you have this type of term. Again, this is the killing term, because it kills off the tumors, and here you've got omega N is a short-range stimulation of growth, and this term here is a long-range, well, actually, that should be long-range sort of suppression, not stimulation again. So short-range stimulation and long-range sort of suppression. And again, F is a smooth decreasing function on 0 to infinity with sort of standard conditions that you sort of determine from the very basic types of models you've used. Okay, and here I've just put, there have been a number, you know, in fact, after I put a few references, I realized there's just a whole, you know, I missed out a whole bunch. But this paper here and Leota again in 97 have used that sort of coupled system to analyze to present a diffusion model of tumor vascularization and growth. Okay, now in the suppression and stimulation thing, you can actually vary that a little bit. You know, you could increase the exponent. You could, it doesn't really depend so much on the particular form there. But if you were to cut out the treatment, okay, and analyze the system, then it's easy to show again by standard methods that there's one global attractor in the positive NK quadrant, given by that. And this is where we actually came in, where because Amit gave me a paper about a year and a half ago, which was, and Philip Hahnfeld was supposed to be here, but he pulled out at the last minute. But they use this sort of coupled system approach to question the maximum tolerated dose paradigm. This is where essentially you sort of give a patient suffering from cancer a maximum tolerable dose that doesn't kill him, and then you leave him for a long enough time to recover and then do the same thing. And I know in radiotherapy, you know, there is this fractionation, and that's sort of found to work better. So in a sense, they were proposing the same thing in chemotherapy, that it's funny, you know, as mathematicians you call it periodic, but here it's called, metronomic therapy. So we've sort of basically started, Rudy, who's somewhere hidden in the background there, has really been analyzing that from a different angle, because I guess we were sort of querying some of their conclusions in the sense that they were saying that it's better to minimize tumor burden and that it's clear that metronomic dosing is the optimum way to go. So that's where we've come, and that's really where we are at the moment. So although we'll be looking for more sort of developments in that direction. Okay, so now, that coupled system really does present a major change in scenario from the single ODE system. Because if I was to go back, let me just go back to the coupled system here. You see, what you can show, you see, this coupled system gives a more mechanistic explanation of the two nearly universally observed phenomena, and that is the sigmoidal growth of the curve and the dependence on the of the tumor on angiogenesis for growth. So it's easy from these models actually to show, even these simple models, that just diffusion of nutrients, limits the growth of the tumor. So they can't grow above a certain thing. And then the tumor has to sort of get near vascularization from various places to sort of actually grow. And when that happens, you know, it does explosively grow to maybe 16,000 times the size of the original tumor within a short period. So what happens is, as time progresses, this inhibition term actually becomes more dominant. So if you were to do this for the endothelial compartment, then it sort of gives you a different perspective, because endothelial cells, in a sense, are more susceptible to genetic and phenotypic changes. So you're moving to a scenario where the endothelial cells may contribute to control of tumor growth. So that's the thing that you couldn't capture in the single equation models, but it's sort of possible to model that in this case. Now, if we go in a level further and look at sort of PDE models, well, that's, you know, another can of worms, because I guess in all of this you want to gear it back to, you know, what are the practical conclusions and what are the recommendations in a certain direction. So for just the simplicity, you know, I'm going to do a couple of simple things, but we're just going to do essentially a 1D PDE, so radial growth, okay, which is always easy. So you can do that with calculus 138 or whatever, Waterloo. So let's have a look at missing here. So this really, you know, if you look at nutrients, suppose we're looking at nutrient concentration, and let's just focus on oxygen. So this is the oxygen is the nutrient here, and this is the sort of uptake, say, of the oxygen. Okay. You can, you know, you could go back to the literature and you see you can model it simply with this sort of diffusion equation. And here, suppose that C2 is the concentration in a normal tissue, and C1 is, we'll assume that, you know, if the oxygen level is below a certain amount, the cells will die. Okay. So for cells that are dead, well, they're not going to uptake any oxygen anyway, so you get that equation without the constant rate of uptake of oxygen. Okay, so that equation there, if we go back here, it's easy to solve, right? You know, because as you can all see, just multiply by the R squared, integrate once, divide by the R squared, and integrate again. Okay, so you do that, and then you can write down, well, let's put down the boundary conditions. That's just a symmetry condition. Okay, you've got radial growth. You're just saying that the rate of change at the center, you know, must be zero. You can't sort of have, you know, the concentration changing, and then this is just the concentration at the boundary of the tumor is just the concentration of the oxygen in the normal tissue, C2. Okay, so now if we actually this doesn't constitute a free boundary problem, so you know, we'll, because I've taken R1 to be equal to zeros, and we've got no dynamics in here, but so forget that free boundary. But the general solution we have is this. Okay, just two integrations, right? Okay, and then using the boundary conditions, you can then write down the general solution here. Okay, I just said note that you have to have C0 is greater than the lower limit, on, you know, cells die below C1. And why is that? Why couldn't you have C1, you know, why couldn't you have the concentration center being below C1? I was going to look at Jeff there, but, you know, I don't think I'll put you on the spot. Yeah, I mean, it's sort of obvious because if you put... you know, if you had it below C1, then by continuity of the concentration, you're going to have a necrotic core, and I'm sort of assuming non-necrotic core. Okay, so it's got to start off at C1. If it's below, you're going to have a region where it's actually... okay, so here's my only picture, which I'm very sorry for. You know, I should have had more pictures in here, but, you know, here's your necrotic core, okay, and the outer rim of the thing, and forget about this here, but basically I'm going to call the critical radius this number that's obtained there. And let's look at what happens if you let the outer radius grow bigger than the critical radius, and let's try and find R1. It's still not a dynamic problem, so in the end we will get to a free boundary problem, but at the moment let's see if we can find R1. So you've got the same equation there, and the boundary conditions are this, okay, and you've got this flux of the nutrient at R equals R1 is equal to zero because you don't really have oxygen going in there. Okay, again, the same integral, two integrations gives you that general integration. Use the boundary conditions. And then, you know, you get this equation after fiddling around. You know, it's a little bit of a mess, but you can get this. And in principle, you know, I said in principle, I didn't even bother to try and do it. You can find R1. But what you can do with this thing is sort of just do a sort of little exercise, you know, let the outer radius tend to infinity, and you actually have R1 over R2 actually tends to a limit. So what you'll find here is that as the conclusion here is that as the tumor gets larger and larger, R2 minus R1 is the proliferating rim. So you've got a necrotic core for R less than R1, and the proliferating rim tends to a constant value H as the tumor gets larger. In this simple model, and we're not saying that this is what happens in practice. But now, if you want to investigate how the growth progresses, you know, you want to put in the time dependence of the radii. And then, you know, I mean, free boundary problems are notoriously horrible because, you know, there isn't any clear-cut theory about how you approach it. But certainly, you need a bit more information. And this is a simple free boundary problem, but still, you need more information to be able to tackle this problem. And so one of the things that you want to do is include some other physical principle, for example, like conservation of mass. So in that case, you know, you want to include assumptions like this. There may be other assumptions that you could make, but cell volume is produced by living cells at a certain rate, and this would depend in general on the nutrient concentration. And cell volume is lost at a certain fixed rate, say, as necrotic cells are broken down and removed. So if you do something like that, then the conservation of mass equations are that. Let's assume for simplicity again that the densities are constant, so we can eliminate those terms on the right there. Then you have a free boundary problem for R1t and R2t, and you have these equations because those terms have dropped out. Now the problem here it becomes that we actually need more conditions. You know, you'll usually find in a free boundary problem, you know, you actually need more conditions to be able to determine something about the free boundary. And in this case, what you assume is that as the tumor is growing, there's a velocity field for the tumor cells. Okay, and so if you look at the velocity field of the tumor cells on the outer boundary, in other words, the R2 of T, then we can write down essentially, you can write down essentially that the rate of change of the outer radius is equal to the velocity at the boundary there. That's what that says. Okay. So you can do do a bit of algebraic manipulation fiddling around, and you can show that the outer radius of the tumor tends to this limit. So again, in this model, you have really a diffusion limited growth. So it doesn't sort of go past that size. So here, just a simple example, because that equation that you've, where is it? Oops. Okay, this thing, you know, if you're looking at radially symmetric stuff, it's sort of easy to solve. I've written it down here again. I didn't even have gone back. Okay, so if you do this, you can solve this very easily, exactly the same way as we did before. Multiply through by R squared, integrate, divide through by R squared, and integrate. So two integrations with these boundary conditions. It's easy to solve that equation. Actually, you could even use complementary functions in particular solutions. I've forgotten. So you can write down the general solution there. Okay. And, you know, you'd have to choose some sort of judicious choices for your parameter values, but you can sketch the concentration level. So what I'm looking at here is the paracrine factors that either promote growth or they inhibit it. So this is something that is produced by the tumor. So for a simplistic thing, you know, suppose, you know, we're looking, this is the paracrine concentration. Suppose we say that tumor cells die below this level of paracrine concentration. Well, what is this, you know, can this tell you anything in a sense about which tumors would grow, which wouldn't, etc.? Well, this type of simple model can give you that type of information. This is a horrible curve, which is all wrong, but, you know, those should be a bit, I think if you put in parameter values, you get more curvature. This is supposed to be R equals 1. The outer radius of your tumor is capital R equals 1. This should be capital R equals 2, and that one's, I've forgotten, something like 5 or 6 radius. Okay. So suppose you say that below 0.4, okay, paracrine doesn't kill off the tumor cells. Then the conclusion you have is that a tumor cell that has radius less than 1 or less than equal to 1, will have no necrotic core because, you know, nothing's above the 0.4 level. A tumor that has radius 2, it will have a necrotic core, and then just there it'll have a proliferating rim. And similarly, if it goes above a certain size, it'll just die off, so it won't grow. That's all necrotic. If the growth is tightly controlled by the inhibitor, then using that model, you can show that if your C1 level is below this fixed value, the tumor is limited. It'll grow to some finite value of R. However, if the from that model, you can show that if the concentration exceeds that, then you can't control the tumor growth at all with the inhibitor, and it has to be some other mechanism like cutting off nutrients or, you know, anti-angiogenic type therapy. Okay. So now, you get to the next stage, so you have to have vascularization for the tumor to grow. And in this case, I only discovered, recently, because I always used to think, oh, tumor angiogenic factor was just one sort of chemical, but, you know, it's like, I mean, it's sort of one name, but there's so many chemicals, you know, endostatin, this, that, you know. So if this is the concentration of tumor angiogenic factor in the region between the tumor and the target blood cell, so in a sense, the tumor secretes this and really sort of entrains these sort of endothelial cells, and you get blood vessels forming. So you can write down a model like this. Now, I should have put names down here, but Chaplin, Byrne, Philip, you know, lots of people have worked on these types of models. And the problem with this is that, you know, these models are notoriously sort of difficult to analyze analytically. So you really have to do numerical simulations, and you have to have biologically realistic values for all the parameters. Oops, I'm running out of time. Okay, so so the cell diffusion, is decomposed into bits that just dependent on diffusion and this sort of chemotactic. So these cells sort of go along a gradient of this tumor angiogenic factor. And in general, when the simulations are done, these things are taken to be constant, although they're, they could in principle be functions of the concentration. It's just, I think it's just too horrendous if you leave all the variability in. Okay, so I think that's about it. So just a brief summary and just conclusions. Well, what can you say? Early on, tumors characterized by sigmoid growth. But even in the ODE or the simple PDE model, avascular tumor growth is diffusion limited. The tumors overcome this stage through neovascularization, by sort of the end of, so angiogenesis. And it appears that all tissues secrete factors to inhibit their own growth. However, there's evidence that tumors produce growth-promoting substances as well. And finally, a defining characteristic, as I find out, of malignant tumors is that they have to metastasize, right? I guess if you have a tumor and it hasn't metastasized, broken off, then you can't really call it a malignant tumor. And there's been work by various people, I've forgotten the names, where they've included the immune system response to this. And, I could, probably take me another week to read through more papers and I'd have some more things. But I think that's essentially it. Okay. Thanks.